Our conference is called Finders Keepers, and we're calling it that because we want to offer to both folks who are looking for a marriage, looking for a relationship, the finders, as well as those who are in a marriage, on how to make a relationship work. How do we do real life kind of marriage? First week we talked about how when we get married initially, or when you first find love, we all run into something we call the ideal. And that is where things are just super, exactly how I always hoped they would be. And we can, like, guess how long that lasts. Like, one Mississippi, two Mississippi, okay? It doesn't last too long before, like, the reality thing hits. And we said the next stage we called the ordeal. And that's like, oh, yuck, what have I gotten myself into? You know, let's make a deal. And the problem, I said, in a lot of marriages is that we hit the ordeal and we don't know where to go. Like, where do you go once you hit the fallen world? Where do you go once you hit, like, I'm fallen, you're fallen, and we're together? And I believe that most of the reason that marriages struggle is because they don't know what the next step is. Well, our conference has sort of been an attempt to try to define what that next step is. What's the third stage of marriage? Where do you go from the ordeal? Now, what most people do is they try to, like, bang their spouse over the head until they're back to the ideal. Like, why aren't you this? Why aren't you that? Why aren't you this? Why aren't you that? Because I want my ideal back. We said instead, God has given us a model for what people need to function in relationships. And we call that the real. What does a real relationship look like? Where you're you and I'm me and we're fallen and we're both under God. And how do we make that happen? We talked about four specific areas that you need to kind of have working in your life, in your relationship, within this real relationship to make marriage work. One of them was attachment. And we talked about that last time. That is being close, intimacy, connection in your relationship, belonging, sharing with one another. The second thing we said you have to have is boundaries. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. This has something to do with separateness. This has something to do with being me versus being you. How do we make sense of being different people in a relationship? A good relationship in the real is going to make sense of that. Thirdly, we said you need to make sense of bad and good. And next week, Lord willing, we will talk about how do you make sense of forgiveness? How is anything good enough in your relationship? And lastly, we said a good real relationship in real life needs to make sense of issues of authority and strength, but also submission. How do you initiate in the world? How do you also make room for other people's needs? So that's kind of our model for our six-week series is how do you make sense of a real relationship with these four aspects kicking inside of it? Like we said, we talked about attachment last time. If you missed it, get the tape. Today we're going to talk about boundaries. And there's a lot of directions you could go with that. We could talk about a sense of self. You know, how do you make sense of you being you in your marriage? We could talk about saying no. But I was thinking that the most applicable way to discuss this, where the rubber will meet the road mostly with y'all in your lives, is to look at the whole issue of conflict. What do we do when you're you and I'm me and we disagree? So what we're going to do tonight is talk about conflict. How do you make sense of it? There have been billion-dollar government grants that have determined that relationships are more difficult when there are two people in them. That's where your tax dollars are going. Basically, conflict happens when you have two or more people in a relationship, both of whom have brains, you know? I mean, if both of you are exactly the same, then one of you is unnecessary, right? So we're going to have conflict. And you singles, as you're looking for a relationship, don't be afraid of conflict. In fact, only when you conflict with somebody can you really know them. They're really being them and you're really being you. I have a friend who was in a relationship and he told the girl, he said, I think we're getting along really well. I think it's time we had a fight. And he's right. That really was what helped them really see who they were. Any of you Matrix fans, remember what the Seraph says in Matrix Reloaded to Neo? You do not truly know anyone until you fight them. Okay? That is true. We're going to make sense of how to deal with conflict. I don't mean anything creepy like weird hatchet killer wacko spouse kind of conflict. You know, like those Lifetime movies for women, you know, with, you know, like Shannon Doherty in Marriage of Fear. You know those? Any conflict is two people making sense of not being the same person. So I hope the question is not, do you have conflict, but what are we going to do with it? And this is where I want us to go. How do we find resolution to conflict in a way that lets both people matter and solves the problem? All right, if you're taking notes, this is going to be on the final. How do you find resolution in a way that lets both people matter and solves the problem? All right? So let's look at conflict. First, we're going to look at what we usually do with it. Then we're going to look at why that doesn't work. And then I'm going to kind of walk you step by step through some ways to think about actually handling a conflict. I want tonight to be pretty practical, like something you can take with you. And this isn't going to be like miracle cure either. This isn't like raise up your spouse in the way that they should go, and when they are old, they will not depart from it. You know, that's not what we're talking about here. All right, how do we usually do it? On a typical day, on a given day, when your spouse does one of those things that ticks you off, or that you've told them you don't want them to do, or that hurts your feelings, or that same thing we've told them to stop doing, or they had that attitude, what's our most instinctive response? What are some of the ways in which we respond in that moment? Anybody? Pardon me? Yes, frying pan, always. Get defensive, good, yeah. Stop talking, withdraw. Exactly. Y'all are getting it. We're all on the same planet here. This is good. Our most instinctive response is something aggressive, something withdrawing, something defensive. Basically, and I want y'all to get this. When we encounter conflict, what happens is that we get triggered in that sort of early reptile brain, kind of caveman brain, that fight or flight thing, okay? It's sort of like a caveman. It's like, do I run from T-Rex or fight him, you know? So first thing we go to is fight or flight. And those are the tools of the trade, right? With 21st century caveman, it's we nag, we withdraw, we throw frying pans, etc. And we're trying to see which of us wins, which of us loses, which of us will be right, which of us will be wrong. Ringing any bells here? Like, tell me my marriage isn't the only one. Good, some nods. All right. In other words, we do the same things in our marriages that you do when a Coke machine doesn't give you what you want. In fact, I like to call this the broken Coke machine phenomenon. Think about it like this. What's supposed to happen with a Coke machine? You're supposed to put money in it and get a Coke. Good. I like to throw in a few questions that I know you can answer, kind of self-esteem builders, you know, something. I always feel like that's important. But what if you put money in a Coke machine and the Coke doesn't drop? What do we do then? Start banging on it. You start rocking it. It's sort of like Costanza and the Twix. Do you remember? It's the candy with the cookie crunch. It's the candy with the cookie crunch, you know? Not a Fifth Avenue bar. Anyway, we start flicking the change return and we write the company. In other words, we get more aggressive, right? So when you want your spouse to do something or not do something and they don't do what you want, what do we tend to do? As they say in New Orleans, we take it up a notch, you know? And we call that a fight, all right? And fights are, that's fun, you know, till 1:30 in the morning. If that's what you're into, that's great. But what is the problem with a fight? And this is point two, why it won't ever work. The problem with a fight is that someone wins and someone loses. And that doesn't really work very well long term. I mean, how many win-lose relationships do you know of that last very long period? Think about it. If you went to Starbucks and they're charging like $8.50 for a cappuccino, which isn't far off, but that's a win for them. It's a lose for you, right? You probably go to cups, okay? But if flip it over, you go into Starbucks and you steal one of those neat little mugs, you know, that's got kind of cool designs on it. That's going to be a win for you and a lose for Starbucks. And that relationship probably isn't going to last very long either, okay? Win-lose relationships don't last very long because ultimately there's always a loser. And the loser ain't very happy. And the loser's going to come back and bite you, all right? The playground principle is this. Hitting the kid with the ball might get you the ball, but it won't get you anyone to throw it with. Okay? So, or as one of my clients told me once, oh, I get it. You can be right or you can be married, but you can't be both. So, what we have to do or else is to find an alternative to the win-lose game, an alternative to the fight-or-flight game, and some way to make it safe for you to find a solution in which you both matter. Which leads us to point number three, and that is, how do we do it better? All right? And I want to get real practical, like I said, and try to give you something that you can take with you. And I'm going to focus tonight on assuming that your spouse is at least willing to work with you to work it out. All right? There's a whole other section we could look into this if we had more time, and that is, what do you do if your spouse goes, I don't care, I ain't changing? The whole unrepentant kind of approach. And if we get into that, ask me in Q&A, or maybe we'll have enough time. But I'm going to assume here that both of you are saying, God, why do we keep doing this? How do we figure this out? All right, just for tonight. And there's also a danger with me getting practical, and that is, it's really easy to sort of come off oversimplified, you know, so bear with me. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, Mr. Shrink and his ivory tower makes it sound easy. Come live in my life, Doc, you know. But we're going to try to give you some principles, and you can ask some Q&A later on. So, when the conflict bomb hits, what should we do? Pause and drink water. Number one. And they get better than this one. This is one of the harder ones. Number one, you have a role. You have a role. Step one is you need to know that given a conflict with your spouse or with your significant other, you daters, you seekers, hopeful finders, there's some way in which you're contributing. And I know that sounds like bad news right now, but bear with me. Even if they're a raging rageaholic, there's some way in which we are playing a role. And the sooner we sort of start trying to find out what that role is, the sooner we can get more power in handling the situation. I believe that one of the most destructive principles in our marriages was begun right off the bat by our father Adam. Because when they sin, God comes and looks for them. And what do? They hide. And what else? They blame. Okay? Basically, Adam says to God, the woman that you gave to me. He blames Eve and God in the same sentence. I mean, that's pretty good for your first day as a sinner. You know? That's like hitting a double play as a rookie. I mean, like, wow. But this has defined marriage, in my view, for the rest of time. I mean, what is it we spend our time doing in our marriages? I call it he language or she language. And that is, you won't believe what he did next, or you won't believe what she said to me. You know, that's where we live. He did this, she did that. And we live kind of as experts on what our spouse is doing wrong. And we're the innocent party. Now, that's fun. I love being innocent. And I love blaming other people. There's nothing funner. But the problem with that is this. To the degree that you aren't playing a role in any way in the problem, you're an innocent bystander in the solution. To the degree that you're not a part of the system that's going on that's creating this problem, you're a passenger in the driver's seat. And I don't mean one of those driver's ed cars that has another steering wheel on the other side. You just better cross your fingers and hope they get it. Because you don't have a role, remember? If you want to change things in your marriage, the first question to ask is, what is the role I'm playing in this dance? And that takes some humility. That takes us being willing to look at some role we have. I invite people to ask the following question as you start looking at conflict in your relationship. What am I a greater expert on? My badness or hers? If asked to give a little presentation, which would be longer? My presentation on her with PowerPoint and handouts. Or am I a little short devotion on me in closing prayer, you know? Which would be longer? What am I a greater expert on? Given any problem in our marriage, I want us to begin by looking at our role in it. Not so you can feel guilty and so you're at fault, but because that's where you're going to get some power to change it. A very wise person in my life once said, the next person to speak holds all the power. Okay? Step two. And here we get more practical. When you feel that caveman brain triggered, when you feel that fight or flight adrenaline rush, when you feel that pop of your spouse saying something that sets you off, go to time out. You know, you put your kids in time out, right? Put yourself in time out. You singles, maybe you were put in time out. put yourself in time out. In other words, When you have a conflict and that jolt hits and your spouse goes, "What did you say?" Or as one woman in my office did the other day, she didn't even say anything, but we knew it was trouble. She just went. It's like the slower the head, the more trouble you're in, you know. We're sorry. We're both sorry. When you feel that jolt, the first thing to do is not do what comes naturally, okay? Back off and think. Remember, when you're first triggered, it's back in this back brain, this reptile brain, this caveman brain, fight or flight. And what we want to do is to get you to cerebral cortex. This is where adults actually solve problems. Problem is, the movement from here to there takes a little bit of time. Time out, okay? The first thing I want you to do is not do what your feelings are telling you to do, all right? You know when Obi-Wan says, "Luke, trust your feelings," okay? Obi-Wan is wrong, all right? He's wrong, okay? That's why he lives all by himself on the planet Tatooine. He can't make a relationship work, you know? It's not with ideas like that. You need to think. So even if you don't know what to do good, just don't do the bad. A few years back, Norma asked me to go pick something up for her at some place and told me where it was, and I ended up like in the ghetto. There was like grass growing up through the parking lot, and I called her on my cell, and we realized the mistake, and I was really frustrated because I'd left from work to do it. And I was just about to go into that sort of like, I can't believe that you, and I stopped myself and I said, okay, I'm about to like start blessing you out and saying, "Oh my gosh, how could you?" You know, and I don't want to do that, but I don't know what a nice person would say. So, I mean, what should I say? And she goes, well, like, hang up and call some of your nice friends and get them to tell you what to say. Really happened. Even if you don't know what to do good yet, don't do the bad, okay? Just stop what you usually do, all right? Pull the alarm. You can also catch your spouse with this. "Hey, honey, whoa, I think we're kind of getting triggered. Let's back off." Or one step further, you can actually set a limit. "You know, you're really kind of getting ugly, and I don't think I want to keep having this conversation if you're going to be ugly." So timeout can come in various ways like that, but somebody needs to stop that physiological process. That way, that's the only hope for getting your brain to figure it out. Number three, do something I call going bird's eye. A lot of the value of marriage therapy, even if your therapist is a complete bird brain, is that it really helps to have somebody else observing your system from the outside. Somebody else to stand and look at y'all, all right? Norm and I used to have what we came to call the "whose day is worse" war. And it goes something like this. Maybe you know something about it. I would come in from a day at work, exhausted. I would assume the "had a bad day" posture with my briefcase in my coat, and stare blankly at Norma and say something like, "Hey," as if to say, "Boy, you should really appreciate how hard I've been out working for the family all day." Okay? The problem is that the source of my adoration is like blankly slumped over the stove cooking something I probably don't want for supper. And she says, "Hey, set the table," as if to say, "Welcome back from your 8-hour vacation." All right? Now, I don't know about her, but I've been helping people all day. And I say, "I'd really rather rest a second," which is code for, "How could you ask me to do anything? All you've been doing is riding around in a minivan all day," all right? And her feeling is, "Well, at least you've had meaningful adult conversations. I've been in the sick room at the pediatrician," you know, and off you go. Anybody know what I'm talking about? And this repeat fight is who's going to be appreciated, who's going to be, you know, affirmed as much as they deserve for blah, blah, blah. But you hear the power struggle in there, by the way? Do you hear the win-lose, which I've erased? Who's going to be appreciated, me or you? Who worked harder today, me or you? And notice in your fights, there's always going to be this pairing off of who's going to win and who's going to lose. Notice that. Now, what I want you to do is to start going bird's eye on it. And bird's eye steps back and observes this dance we're doing and says, "Hey, Sherlock, this is not my first rodeo. Hadn't we done this before? You know, what are we doing?" Now, notice the pronoun, "we." The world changes in your marriage with the pronoun "we." Now, I'm not saying me or you or he or she. I'm saying us. And the moment you say us, you've backed up and you're looking bird's eye and you're saying, "Wait a minute, I kind of feel like you don't care how hard I work and you don't feel like I appreciate all you do with the kids all day and the plumbers and the bills and all of that. And we're kind of having this competition. What are we doing?" You see? Bird's eye is the ability to step back and observe what we're talking about. Maybe you realize I hadn't been recording my checks again, and you start going off at me, and I get defensive, and there we go again. Birdseye says, wait a minute, we're doing that checkbook thing. We've been doing that since our honeymoon, you know? Let's time out and back up and think. Birdseye is not about the me and the you, it's about the y'all. In fact, sometimes I call this y'allness. This is one way in which being a Southerner can actually help your marriage. Y'allness. What is up with y'all? I did a conference in Denver a while back, and they know what I was talking about. It's like, but being able to back up and look at what you're doing, all right? Go in bird's eye. Number four, I want you to address the hurt. And this may be the most important one I tell you. The difference between a conflict and a fight has to do with hurt. What is hurt? Anybody want to take a shot at it? What does it mean if I hurt you?
Feel the pain.
Feel the pain. And how am I inflicting pain on you to hurt you? What is it I do? How do I hurt you emotionally? Take away from them. That's really well put. Another word I like is diminishment. Think about the things that hurt you. You criticize my parenting. You say I don't make as much money as your friends' husbands do. Or once we get in fighting and it gets ugly, we start kitchen sinking. That's sort of like, you always do this and you never do that. Or, you know, I'm sick of dealing with you or whatever. Or, yeah, you would think that. You hear the diminishment? And once a fight starts to get ugly, we start to take away from someone else's dignity. We start to diminish them. And that creates hurt. Well, here's one of the secrets of the universe, I think. The reason that people have trouble making conflicts and fights end well is not because of poor communication or problem-solving skills or whatever. It's because most of us don't know how to resolve hurt once it happens. Okay? And this is key, and it'll so help your fights. Almost every fight involves not one element, but two. And that is, we typically start off with an original problem. And then before too long, somebody gets hurt. And now you have two problems, not one. Ever notice how in your relationship, married or dating or whatever, simple kind of problems all of a sudden somehow turn into, you know, Iwo Jima? You know, you're talking about how should we redecorate the playroom? And 2 hours later, somebody's going, well, maybe we should just split up, you know? And it's like, how did this get here, you know? That happens because when we're disagreeing about a problem, it's really easy to hurt someone or for them to hurt you. You know, you say something like, what do you mean radars are deductible? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And boom, you're there. It's that easy, all right? And when we do that, we suddenly move from having one problem to having two problems. Now we're not just disagreeing about the car insurance. Now you hurt my feelings. Now you're treating me like I'm stupid. Now you're criticizing the way I handled it. Now you went and brought my mama into it. And somehow, you know, you've crossed the line, all right? And so this is key in making sense of your fights. Maybe you have a problem. But until at this point, once you cross this line, unless you resolve this hurt, you ain't going nowhere, boy. All right? And a lot of people wonder why we keep having the same fight over and over and over again. Well, because you talk about 5 minutes on the problem, and then you hurt each other, and you spend the next 3 hours on the hurt, and you never resolve it. And guess what? Well, Mr. Problem here, he's all neglected. Nobody's paying attention to him, and he's like the last kid picked at soccer. I mean, nobody's even paying attention to that anymore. Okay? So if we're ever going to resolve Mr. Original Problem, we got to deal with the second problem first, the hurt. And we do that with a little something called understanding. And that means that the only thing that makes hurt get better, if it's that I just was late for dinner, or if I really wounded you, the only thing that makes hurt get better is for you to see and know that I get it, that I understand at some level. And that doesn't mean necessarily I agree, or that you have to agree with your spouse. I want to talk for a minute on what it means just to get it. Because if you never get it, if your spouse never feels like you get it, what they're saying, or understand where they're coming from, you will live with the hurt forever. And guess what? You'll never get back to solving the problem. That's why you've been having the same fight since college. Okay? Now, this whole getting it, understanding bit is not real complicated. We experience it all the time in everyday life. Think about it like this. Somebody cuts you off on the interstate. that makes you mad. You go, God, what an idiot. But then you see him look in his rearview mirror and he goes like that. And what do? We go, oh, okay. He knows he's an idiot. All's forgiven, you know? And all of a sudden, it's all better. You've had a new relationship. It's been broken and repaired all in like, you know, a half a mile. Why can't you do this in your marriage? But what's he doing? What has he done? He has acknowledged, I know I'm an idiot. I about killed us both. And you feel better. Now, what we got to have is that mirror wave in our marriages. What marriages do is somebody cuts in front of the other person, they never do the mirror wave, and y'all go around tailgating each other and throwing rocks at each other for the rest of your life. All right? Somebody's got to do the mirror wave. All right? And that means we got to communicate to our spouse, whether we agree with it or not, ultimately, that from their perspective, we can see it. We can kind of get that it's valid in some way, that they're not crazy. Which reminds me of a really dumb little joke. I'm just going to go ahead and tell you now, get it over with. Before you can criticize your spouse, you need to walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you're a mile away from them, and you have their shoes. I didn't even think I'd get that much laugh out of it. I thought it'd just be really awkward. One of the ways to build a marriage is for the speaker to look really awkward in front of you, and then you can rib each other and talk about it on your way home. All right, let's see. All right, yeah, we want to sort of get a sense that from their perspective we get it. Now, let me just give you an example. Let's walk through one that we all kind of experience. Let's say you start fussing about parenting issues and it gets nasty. And it turns into a fight, and she says, you sit around and you don't get involved with the parenting, and I'm sick of it. And he shoots back, well, if you didn't criticize every parenting thing I did, maybe I'd be more involved. And she says, well, you yell at them. How do you expect me to do anything but criticize you? And it sounds like they're going to have a great night, doesn't it? But you hear the two problems? What's the original problem? Parenting. They're disagreeing about parenting. And you hear the hurt? They're being ugly and hurtful to each other. I want you to develop an ear for those two things. The problem is parenting. How are we going to parent? Then the hurt jumps in and starts being something about how I don't like you. Now, the only way out of this, the only way out of the volatility of these feelings is for some way there to be understanding. Which, easy, right? But here's the problem, and here's why we have fights. The only way to heal our spouse's hurt is to hear them, right? For us to get it. But face it, none of us want to do that. Why? Because we're all wanting to be heard and understood ourselves. That's why we get in these tug-of-war fights. That's why we get in those fights about who gets heard and who gets understood. That's why I say things like, I did not say that. That's why I say things like, you're putting words in my mouth. That's why I say things like, oh yeah, but you. Do you hear the tug of war? I want to be understood. No, I want to be understood. No, I want to be understood. And you go back and forth, two ticks and no dog. Ping pong match. Now the only way out of this, I believe, is to use a very sophisticated, deep psychological technique. We're going to take turns. All right? Can you see if you can bear with me on that? I want him, let's start with him. Let's let him hear her first. He's the leader of the home. I want him to say to her, whoa, let's time out. It's getting nasty in here. Let's take about 15, 20 minutes. Let's back off. I want him to say, we're having the fight about parenting and we're getting ugly about it. Let's back off and try some understanding. And then I want him to say, tell me what you need me to hear. I'm going to stop shooting back at you and I want to get you. Now, I want you to promise you're going to get me next. We're going to take turns. I'm not just going to like hang out there, but I want to get you first. And I want her to say, okay, it feels like to me, that's a good start. It feels like to me is a lot better than you, okay? It feels like to me that you're passive and uninvolved with the kids. It feels like to me that I'm a single parent. And when you do get involved, you don't support me. Now, if you're that guy, what does everything in you want to say at this point? Yeah, but you, I did not. You feel it? You feel it? Isn't it interesting how hard it is for us to hear anything bad about us? But if little cosmic safety tip, the next thing that needs to happen is for him to not say, yeah, but you. Why? Because that put him back in the tug of war. All right? That fight to be understood. So if this is ever going to be a fight they don't have to the old folks home, he needs to deal with his need to defend. Don't you all have a need to defend? That's something in you that has trouble hearing the truth. You're going to come back and defend. If he can sit on his need to defend and communicate back to her that he gets it. And that means he will say, let me see if I understand this. And this is going to feel artificial at first, but so did a golf club the first time you swung it, okay? Let me see if I get this straight. You're telling me it feels like I leave everything up to you. And when I do get involved, I make it more difficult. So you feel like you're a single parent. I can see how that would tick you off. Now, inside you can be thinking, I disagree with you. But I want you to at least acknowledge, okay? And he needs to say that until she goes, yeah, that's it. That's what I'm saying. That's when she is gotten, when she feels gotten, and she can start letting go of the hurt and the anger. Then you will get your turn, guy. Don't worry. I promise you. And when it's his turn, he can say something like, well, from my end, it feels like nothing I do is good enough for you. It feels like you take control of the parenting and you don't give me enough room to get involved. And it feels like I don't support you because I think you're as hard on them as you are on me. And she needs to hear that and sit on that need to defend and say back to him, so to you it feels like you just kind of give up because I'm just controlly. And they need to do that back and forth until they both feel gotten. This is the hardest thing I will tell you tonight, because our need to defend is so big that we don't have room to hear one another. But if we don't make room to hear one another, we're going to live in that tug of war forever. And that's why you're having conflict in your marriage that doesn't go away, because you never get to heal the hurt. So slowing it down and taking turns and making room for each one of you to be heard is the only way that you'll be able to break up your fusses. And you won't believe how good it feels once you start doing this to realize they were actually listening to you rather than working on their comeback. All right? So we kind of have three H's here. Hearing heals hurt. Hearing heals hurt. And as long as y'all are fighting to be heard instead of letting one another be heard, you're never going to get past it, right? So, you have a role. Go to timeout. Go bird's eye. Address the hurt. And fifthly, let's solve the problem. Remember the old problem over there? The one that usually we don't get to because we're so busy being hurt? Remember we said every fight is hopeless because it starts off as a win-lose. Win-loses never get better, right? So, buckaroos and buckarettes, the only way to make a fight end well is to create, instead of a win-lose, a win-win. And that means that point your spouse just made, the one that you just heard, has got to somehow figure into the solution. Okay? Or else it'd be win-lose again, right? Whether I like it or not, or despise it or not, somehow we both are going to have to matter in how we solve this problem. And I promise you, that's not going to be exactly what you want. But the day you said I do, you basically agreed that your desires would not be the only thing determining what your life was like. Our family used to have an annual fight at Christmas over the Christmas card picture. We have three girls, and you can imagine what picking the Christmas card picture was like when they were teenagers. And foolishly, we let them decide. That was our problem. That was our problem. Never mind. I figured it out. No, seriously. One year, they completely could not agree. And the problem was always this. There's three of them. There was always one of them that hated the picture. You know, any given two would agree to a picture, and there would be a third who did not. And she'd be like, no, don't pick that one. My hair is poofy. You know, don't poofy hair. So one year we actually said they were unable to find a solution. They were unable to actually come up with one they agreed on. And we said, well, you're going to have to find one, or we're going to pick it. You know, that's all they needed to hear. They suddenly got busy compromising. And they picked one, and frankly, all that could be said about this picture was that nobody hated it. All right. It wasn't even a good picture. Upon realizing that, Callie, who is 17 at the time, she's now a therapist. Karma. Wow. Callie said, you can hear it in what she's about to say. She said, oh, I get it. Compromise is where everybody's equally unhappy. Then she paused and said, you know, if I got my pick, at least somebody in the house would be happy. The way it is now, nobody's happy, you know. So, if you're fussing and fighting in your marriage, this is your goal. Dr. Cox's medicine for your marriage is for you to be mutually unhappy. All right? My clients love it. They're like, thanks, doc. Now we're both unhappy, you know. Seriously, what win-win means in your marriage is that we will both matter in the solution. No matter how much you and I both have to give, we're both going to matter. And I can trust that I don't need to make you let it matter. That means, to put it dumbly and simply, if I want Chinese food and you want Mexican, win-lose says, I'm going to get Mexican, tough for you. Win-lose says, I'm going to get Chinese, tough for you. Win-win says, we'll figure something out. Even if we have to go get Mexican and run by and pick up Chinese on the way home for you. Or maybe go to Chili's and get a Southwestern egg roll. I mean, we're going to figure something out to where you all matter. Okay? I saw a couple a while back, and he had a pretty good job, but he wanted to go to med school. And she had a pretty good job, but she wanted to quit it and have babies. Now, what would his going to med school mean to her baby dreams? Gone. What would her quitting her job do to his doctor dreams? Gone. Welcome to every marriage I know has a problem like this. And we had a real potential for a win-lose, and they were living that way. They were living in that tug of war that says, I shouldn't have raced the win-lose up there. They live in that win-lose tug of war of which one of us is going to get what we want. They were living in that panic that I've got to take it from you before you can take it from me. All right? And they were scared. They were afraid they were going to get left out in the cold. But we tried to start talking about win-win. Like, how do we get it to where you both matter? Win-win is not a solution, it's a commitment. It's like the Marines, no man left behind. It means that we can both rest in the fact that whatever solution we're going to come up with, we're going to both matter, all right? And these guys actually started working with that, and they came up with ways that they could both get what they wanted and the other not die on the vine. Like, he thought about nurse prac school instead of going to med school. They talked about working on their investments and shifting them around so they could have more income now, and maybe she could quit and still have babies. But more importantly is they stopped living in that tug of war. They stopped living in that place where their marriage was a place that was frightening, where they were afraid, if I let go my fist, you're going to take what I need, and I'm not going to be taken care of. The major reason that we fight is that we don't trust our spouse to do that. So we try to take, and we try to fight for what's ours. Now, is finding a win-win hard? Yeah. If I'm making it sound easy, I'm doing you wrong. But what I know is that at that point, we're talking about a problem, not a fight. And that's what marriage is two people who are solving hard problems together, not fighting, okay? There's always a solution if you try to win-win. We had a situation when Callie went to TCU in Texas, our oldest, and I wanted the whole family to drive out to Texas together. Kind of, you know, we're all a family unit, kind of for the last time, we're going to drop Callie off. Well, there was a conflict with the girls' school, the young two, and Norma, it was really important to Norma that they stay here and be able to start school on time. And so we had kind of a win-lose. I wanted to go to Texas, Norma wanted to stay here. What are we going to do? Well, great opportunity for a fight. Well, we started trying to think win-win. How do we both matter here? And I said, I really want him to go. What do you need? She said, well, I really need him to be at school on time. And we came up with, well, I'll tell you what, you let him come to Texas, I'll buy him two airline tickets out of Dallas Love Field. We'll fly him home Sunday. And it's like, okay. But the mentality is what I want you to get, not the individual solutions. The mentality of, instead of trying to take this from you or throw my rank around because I'm the head of this house or nag you until you give in, those are power plays. Win-win says we are committed in our relationship to making this work together. How do I give and you give, and let's find some way that we both matter, okay? You get that mentality in your marriage, and it's going to change the way fights go. So the enemy is not your spouse. The enemy is the tug of war. The enemy is the power struggle. So with a repentant spouse, a spouse who's interested in working with you, stop blaming. You're responsible too. Go to time out. Give yourself a chance to move from reptile brain to your frontal lobes and start thinking. Don't do what comes naturally. Go bird's eye. Start asking, what are y'all doing? And understand make sure that even though you think what your spouse is saying comes from planet zero, that you at least get their position in some way. And find a win-win. You need to know that each other has each other's back. I want you to write these down. I want you to write these down somewhere. When Norm and I were learning these in our own life, I had them written down on a piece of paper and stuck in a bookshelf. And the moment that cork got popped, the moment that conflict bomb hits, I would go, wait a minute. And I would go get it and go, all right, step one. All right, I needed sort of to think digitally instead of reacting. Write them down and use them in the moment. Try to walk through them together. Now, looking at our time, tell you what, let's do a little bit of questions on that. And I think we have enough time to where I could maybe talk some about what do you do about issues your spouse is not interested in working with you on, in which they're not interested in a win-win, they don't care. More limit-setting underpinning issues, we can have a little time for that. Were there any questions on this stuff so far? Yes, that's a very good question. Her question is, what if, any of the questions that you ask, we're keeping theoretical, broaden them to everyone. What if you have a situation in which you're interested in sort of walking through this process, but your spouse isn't? What if they say sort of oh, that sounds like therapist talk. Let's see. Let me think about that one. In case I didn't tell you, I'm not Brainiac the omniscient. I don't know the answers to all questions. Well, one of the things I would do is ask them. Somebody sort of, if I have an idea and somebody shoots it down and says, I don't like that. That sounds this or that. I don't want to fight them on it. I want to say, okay, obviously that we're not doing well. You got another solution. What would you do instead? In other words, I'd kind of let them be on the hot seat a little bit. What would you like to do? Now, depending on what the issue is, if it's just a disagreement, I would sort of try to get them to bring it in on their terms as much as possible. You're informed by this, and I would let them bring their stuff in too. If it becomes an issue that's more painful, a real hurtful issue, I think that would start applying into some of our more limit-setting ways about how to deal with an unrepentant person. In other words, if somebody's saying, I'm doing this, I'm not really interested in changing, then I might want to learn more about setting some limits on them, which I'll talk about in just a second. But when anybody shoots me down, I don't like the way you're handling it, I want to say, okay, well, how would you handle it? And let them kind of do a little of the work. Anybody else have any thoughts on that question? I'm not super satisfied with my answer. That's really good. This is assuming that the one individual's in therapy, the other person's kind of dissonant, and Janie Pillow's recommendation is say, I'm at therapy trying to grow. You are certainly invited to attend, and you can hear what's really going on. You can have your input. Good. Thank you. Relationships are like a GPS. You have a destination, but it's always recalculating. That's good. With a British accent. Australian recalculating. Well, if you can have that level of flexibility in your relationship, then you're going to have a lot less fights. I mean, you kind of have a destination in mind, but if you're willing to be flexible in terms of recalculating, it's a beautiful thing. He said when they find themselves getting too face-to-face, too into it, one of the ways you do time out in a sense is go control. Exactly. I get clients to pick out their own. They'll go red alert, red flag, time out. Whatever. If you have a way that you both can kind of trigger it, nothing productive is going to happen from this point on. It's a good way to stop it. What he was saying for any of you who didn't hear it is he said one of the questions that would be productive to ask is if I'm living in a win-win, if winning is that important to me, it would seem productive to ask myself, why is it so important for me to win? Is that accurately? Y'all want to talk some about that? Why? Why is it so important to us to win? We're body of Christ here. What are your thoughts? All right, so what she's saying is that a lot of times we're coming into a marriage with some history, baggage maybe, and unresolved things maybe from growing up, things that I had that I need that are triggering me now. Think about how much, when you come into a marriage, you come in with the deficits and the blind spots that you left childhood with. And something, we're going to talk about this the last week we meet, something inside of us is looking to get those blind spots filled. And boy, if I find out you're not going to fill them, it ain't going to be pretty. All right? So I'm going to get triggered and I'm going to want to win at that point. Good. Yes, sir. Now, one thought about that, since every one of us feels that way, whether we know it or not or whether we admit it or not, If you realize you feel that way, tell your spouse. You know what? One of the reasons I hang on and fight you to the death is because it's too scary to me to admit that I might be wrong. I just kind of need you to know that. Hey, naked, not ashamed. Might as well get it out in the open. One way to destroy a fear that controls us is to go ahead and tell the person we're afraid of. I'm afraid of you. I want to try to win because it makes me feel good and it makes me feel really terrible not to. Let's get it out. That's one of the ways that confessing our sins actually heals them. It's one of the reasons therapy works. I'm actually going to, I have like, my fourth category of authority and submission. I'm going to talk about leadership and submission and all that then and try to address that. But let me try to address it now. If I am put in an authority position of my home and I want to do so in a way that honors God and is like Christ, then I'm going to really want to know what's the most life-giving way to run a relationship. If I'm in charge, I could have a bureaucracy. I could have a autocratic plutocracy. I could have any kind of government that I want because I'm the head, right? Well, I want a relationship in which everyone matters in the image of God. And yeah, you can find the sort of, yeah, but if push comes to shove and if somebody has to make the call, yeah, we can do the leadership thing. But on 99 out of 100 situations as leader, I want to say, I'm too dumb to make decisions in spite of my wife. I want her input. And if I want to honor her like Christ would, then I want to flex some of me to let her win too. And I want to model for her and my children what real Christ-like submission and leadership looks like. And that is, I'm willing to bend the knee to include you. So leadership is an undefined term. I can lead in any way I want. I recommend we lead like this and say, I want to make as much room for you as I possibly can. Because that's what Christ did. I'll die if I have to. Being the leader means I'm the first to go to Golgotha. If you want to join me, great, but I'm going ahead. That's what leadership means. Janie's point is that one of the things that I could say of an overarching principle, maybe over all of this in a sense, is to have, in an ideal sense, is if you could have a sense of what your goals are together, that a lot of these individual details, the little junk, the little garbage kind of trickles down underneath it. Because we are both working for something more overarching and ultimate, and it makes the little details have less power. The decisions are made in conjunction with these goals, so they're not just arbitrary your way versus my way. I think I'm going to throw out a couple ideas on dealing with when spouses aren't willing to flex. Just last couple minutes. Is that okay? Y'all have more questions? I'm just going to hit three little points here when you're dealing with either a spouse who doesn't care or a spouse who can't change. All of us have something in our lives that we have trouble getting around. And I just want to give you a couple of ideas about thinking about that. And this might be trying to squeeze too much into 5 minutes, but we'll give it a shot. Number one, your spouse has an issue. They don't listen to you. They don't care. They don't want to change. The first thing I want you to do, the first level of intervention, is really technical and hard. I want you to ask them, would you be willing? Magic amulet. Now, why in the world would that help? Think about it like this. When was the last time regarding a conflict in your marriage that you felt asked? What we usually feel is, why aren't you this? You never that. It's your turn to whatever. We're used to demands and control. I recommend asking, would you be willing? In fact, I tell people in a tongue-in-cheek way, one way to guarantee your spouse does your bidding is a two-point process. Ask them, would you be willing, and then give them full permission to not do it. In other words, say, would you be willing to talk to me about your day when you get home? I know that you've had a full day, and I know you're tired, and I know it's a lot on you, and I would really understand if you need to say no. But would you be willing to consider that? Would you be willing to record your checks? I know I nag you about it, and I know I shouldn't, but it really would help me. But I know you're usually writing them with the kids in the grocery store, and they're dragging on you, and you don't have time to do it. So if you can't, I really get it. But would you be willing? And then shut up. Now, this isn't just being nice. This is powerful. Why? Well, number one, when we demand from people, we take away their chooser. Asking gives it back. In other words, if I live in a way that won't let someone say no to me, they can't say yes to me. Think, ladies, if you demanded to your husband, you will bring me flowers today. What are his options there? Can he bring you flowers? No. I mean, if he does, he's a robot. Demand never works. Asking gives back their opportunity to say yes. Secondly, asking does something a little more sneaky, and that is asking forces people to look at what they really value. Would you be willing, as opposed to control, says, you know what? The willing is yours, and the unwilling is yours too. In other words, I'm not going to control you. I'm not going to make you. This is no longer about nagging me. This is no longer about me bugging you about stuff. This is you being completely free and choosing to not be caring to someone who is as dear to you as your spouse. What does that say about you? It's kind of like that guy said to Martin Luther about the doctrine of justification. He said, well, if that was true, then someone could just go live as he pleased. And Martin Luther said, exactly. Now, what pleases you? Asking and not controlling forces people to actually look at what I would choose. Would you be willing? That's a very useful phrase I want you to learn in your marriage. Would you be willing to do that? Now, some people will see that as a freedom for license. You're not going to get on my case anymore. Would I be willing? No. All right? And we have to move up a notch with them. You'll notice it's kind of like God. It's kind of like Matthew 18. God tries A, and if that don't work, he takes it up to B. And if B don't work, he takes it up to C. And he can keep going, okay? So asking nicely is the first step. Like Patrick Swayze in the great film Roadhouse. Be nice until it's time to not be nice, all right? If asking is going to get their attention, the next thing we can let them deal with is reality. On this planet, everything has a cause and effect result, a cost to it. And everyone is disciplined. Children are disciplined by their parents. Adults are disciplined by reality. I can eat anything I want. My pants might not fit. I don't have to pay my taxes. The black helicopters might start circling. Okay? I don't have to go to work. But Paul says that I might not eat. All right? We get reality. Now, given almost anything I'm doing that's jerky, there's going to be a cause-effect reality in it somewhere, and you can bet the family nest egg that if you let me get away with it, I'm going to keep doing it. All right? So step two is to just help people who don't care see some of the consequences of what they're doing in reality. You know, one of the dumb obvious ones is the spouse who drinks too much and their spouse who calls in at work and makes excuses for them. Just step out of the way. Let the train hit them. Let them start to reap some of the consequences in reality that they're creating. Sometimes you can just tell them softly the reality they're creating. I had a client of mine who had a spouse who was very critical and very hurtful, and they came up with a really good one. They just started saying in a sweet, kind way, every time you treat me like this, I feel something in my heart pulling further and further away from you. Now, that's not a threat. That's not a demand. I'm just saying you're not repentant and wanting to work on how we grow, but here's the cost of it. I just need you to know that. Think about how much God treats us unrepentant people like that. He's saying, if you do this, this is going to happen. If you do that, that's going to happen. Just the natural reality consequences. And a final one to think about. Like I say, this should kind of be a talk in itself, but I want to just give you a little overview. Another is consequences we apply. Sometimes we need to apply consequences. Basic principle of the universe, what repentant people need is loving acceptance and grace and nurture. What unrepentant people need is to become repentant people. Okay? And how you do that is usually with consequences and limits. One of my favorite one of these was done to me by my wife. I like to cook, and I've cooked for a long time. And when I first started learning to cook, I could cook pretty well, but I couldn't clean up at all. I mean, I would clean, but I'd man clean. You know what I mean? There's still like corn, like along the baseboards, you know, and you know, sticky stuff on the floor. And ultimately, she and I'd have a wonderful meal together, which she acted like she enjoyed. But then she would end up in the kitchen after I'm like, you know, eating chocolate and ice cream in the next room. And she's like cleaning up the kitchen for real. And she kept asking me, I really want you to clean the kitchen. Would you be willing to clean the kitchen? I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. And I was an unrepentant spouse. And finally, she looked at me in the sweetest way and she said, you know, I really like your cooking, but I really think I don't want to share in the cooking with you if you're not going to really clean up. I'd rather eat cereal. And all of a sudden, she gave me this beautiful choice. It wasn't shamey, it wasn't controlly, but she laid a consequence on me. If I want to eat this fancy food, I can eat it by myself. Well, I'm clean like a washerwoman now. As a matter of fact, after this conference, ladies, I'll pass a sign-up sheet around. I'm going to do a Cleaning Your House for Men conference. You can sign your husbands up. Be glad to teach them all my secrets. Anyway, think about it like this. I had an individual tell me not long ago, my spouse stood over me for a solid hour and criticized me. And my question to him was, at least as far as I can tell, you got legs. Like, why did you stay there? Why did you sit there for an hour? Consequences. If you're going to talk to me like that, I'm going to need to leave. With an alcoholic, if you're going to keep drinking, you know what? I'm going to need to call your friends. Or we're going to need to do an intervention. Or there's going to be treatment. Or I'm going to move to mom's until you get this together. Good limits are not a rule about you. Stop drinking. Good limits are a rule about me. If you're going to be hurtful to me, if you're going to yell at me like that, I don't think I'm going to talk to you. It's a consequence I put out to take care of me. All right? If you're not willing to pick up your socks, then I have this bag and I'll put all your socks in the bag, but they'll never get washed. You'll have a bag of dirty socks. Now choose, right? Consequences. Now, nothing I'm telling you is going to make anybody change. Those are just some pointers. Things that make people change are called control, and you can't control people. Ultimately, though, the question is, regardless, in order to relate to someone who is difficult and unrepentant, we need to relate righteously regardless, so to speak. How do I live in a way that's most like God want me to live? Rats. I wish I could give y'all some time for questions about that. Anyway, let's close in prayer. Thanks. Father, thank you that you solve your conflict with us. We are unrepentant. Every one of us has come to you repentant at some point in our life, but we continue to have areas of our lives that are not repentant. We continue to relate to other people in ways where we don't care. And yet you solve the conflict with us. We deserve distance from you. We deserve no resolution with you. We deserve alienation from you. And yet you approach us and you come after us and you pursue us and you say, like you did to Adam, where are you? And you seek us and you want to restore a relationship. We're humbled by that. We don't deserve that. And we ask that you help us to glory in that in our relationship with you. And we ask that you help us be able to apply that same way to our spouses, that we would relate to them like you relate to us, with the same level of truth-telling and compassion. We pray all these things in the name of Christ. Amen.